Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, it's Rebooting the News, and we're ready for another week, right, Jay?
Rebooting the News, number 37.
Wow, amazing.
Dave, you were in New York last week, but you're back on the West Coast now, right?
I know, and it's freaking cold here, too. Yes, I was there, and I'm back.
So what were some of the highlights of your trip? I know you went to the New York Times, and I'm dying to find out what happened. I did hear a little bit about it from Jennifer Preston, social media editor of the New York Times, who's also been a guest on this show.
Right.
But I didn't really get a good report. So you want to tell us a little bit about what happened? It was a lunch for Dave Weiner, as I understand.
I guess. They had, you know, it was upstairs in the New York Times cafeteria.
Which is nice.
And... there were a lot of characters there. They were both editorial people, you know, Jennifer Preston, who I learned, is not so much the social networking editor at the New York Times, but she is herself a social network. She's a tiny little person, but huge personality. And, she's just like a bee running around, you know, with her fingers and everything. And she's quite the orchestrator. And she put this lunch together. And sitting around the table were editors, sports, the guy from the sports page, Brian Stelter, who is the youngest guy ever to start on the New York Times. There were technical people there. There was a guy, Silence Matters, Jeremy. I cannot remember his last. I'm terrible with names. His name was Jeremy, and he was really interesting. Had a lot of interesting things to say. I don't know. I mean, my upshot, and it was kind of like a, you know, Patrick De La Forge was there. These are mostly people we know from Twitter, and which I think makes them exceptional people from the Times. Whatever it is that drew them to Twitter, I think makes them different in some regards. But you know, New York Times people sort of have the same view of the world. I think you've seen this as well, that sort of like you have to be very impressed with the world from their point of view before we can even talk about anything else. And so there's that. And I guess my point for them, which I repeated over and over again, and I don't think I convinced anybody, is that they should view Twitter as competition and don't embrace it so cheerfully, you know, in terms of, okay, you have to embrace it now because it's late, but please be thinking about this the same way that the railroads should have been thinking about airlines in the time when that transition was taking place. I think finally we really are seeing, I feel this way, that we're finally seeing the internet become the news medium of today. You know, it's no longer the future thing. And I think Twitter is, as I've said before, at least a dress rehearsal for that. So the discussion, as far as I was concerned, centered around that. We did get a little bit into the technical side of things, and that got heated. I don't know exactly what their vision is for themselves, why they even have developers inside the New York Times. I really don't see a whole lot coming out of there that is all that useful, nor all that grounded in what I think the future of the news organization is going to be. I think probably some of the limits are due to the fact that they have this intense political environment there, which sort of keeps people from doing too much. So, I don't really know. I mean,
interesting. All right. Well, now you at least put names to faces, and they know you a little bit more, which is good.
I'm not sure that it is good, but it's good from my point of view. I'm glad to put names to faces for sure. You'd have to ask them. I'm not sure they like me very much, I gotta say. But I mean, you know, whatever. Maybe that isn't the worst thing in the world, huh?
Well, moving on,
hmm?
WordPress certainly understands that Twitter is part of the new news system. And made some interesting moves this week, and I think we should talk about them since they have come up before. Why don't you explain to me, because I want to hear it from you, because I didn't quite understand it the way you phrased it at your blog. What is exactly did WordPress do this week when you use this term implemented Twitter's API? For me, that didn't make any sense at all. So could you just explain a little bit so I make sure I understand it?
I think it's fascinating that, to me, those phrases, saying I had breakfast this morning, it's pretty basic stuff, but I think it's interesting that, I guess the word implemented doesn't really mean very much, does it?
No.
What does it mean? What does implemented mean to you? It probably isn't even a word, is it?
It is a word.
It is?
Yeah, it means they put it into practice.
Oh, well, in that case, that's what they did. In other words, think of an API as almost like a contract. It doesn't have any physical substance. Rather, it's an agreement that if I say this, you will say this, and then I can then take that information and take one or two pieces of it and send it back to you, and then you'll say something else. So, for example, an element of an API, of the Twitter API, would be here's the user, jrosen_NYU, and here's that user's password, so two pieces of information. Now tell me what's in his timeline. Mm-hmm. Timeline being what you see on the screen when you log into Twitter. And then
that's
what it passes
contract.
Back. Pardon me?
That's the contract.
The contract is, yes, if you say this and this and ask for this, ask for the timeline, it's contingent on that the username and the password agree, that is that user's password, right?
Right.
Okay. If they are in agreement, then I will return to you the timeline. The timeline itself is a structure of information, and it's got, 20 elements to it, and each of those elements then in turn has sub-elements, first of all, the elements are individual messages or statuses is what they're called in
right.
the internal language of the API. And then each of those has elements to it, like who is the author of that status message and at what time was that issued. And now lately they've added geo data. So where was that user when he or she entered that status message? And so there's all that kind of information. Then I could say, okay, well, now I know a new user. Let me ask you for some information about that user. That would be another API call. And then the Twitter doesn't need a password for that. It's willing to return that information without a password. And so it would return to you information like, well, here's the picture of that user. This is where they're from. This is how they describe themselves. This is the URL associated with their profile. All of that should be familiar to you as a user, right? That's how a user interface is constructed. It's a breakdown of the sort of basic elements of the world that you live in this case, Twitter, and then a conversation that can take place between two pieces of software. It's different. It's not people that are conversing here, but it's the software. So for WordPress to implement, let me stop there for a second. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, perfectly.
Okay, good. So now for WordPress to implement the Twitter API means that they will now accept, they will talk the same language that Twitter will. So in other words, you give me a username and a password, and it will return back to you a timeline, right? And now the username and the password in this case will not be Twitter usernames and passwords. They'll be WordPress usernames and passwords. And the status messages will be their last, the 20 Well, you know, there's the interesting thing. I have not investigated this yet, right? Question is, where do they get the concept of a timeline in there? How do they do a timeline, right?
I That's
mean,
what I didn't get.
we're
Yeah.
both. Yeah. Oh, you didn't get it either. Okay, so I haven't figured that out yet. I was traveling, so I didn't have the time to actually sit down and, you know, take it apart and figure out what they mean. There must be a way of synthesizing a timeline out of WordPress. So we'll figure that out. I'll have that for you next week.
All right.
Yeah.
So
The
what
idea,
are the potential implications of this?
Well, you could, well, okay, the goal that they had, the short-term goal, and the only one that they've stated, is that you should be able to use at least some of the Twitter clients to access WordPress data. So they did this experiment with Tweety, and apparently it worked. So that's sort of the acid test. That's why anybody emulates an API. It's so that you can get the or implements. There's a new word. I used the word emulate. Maybe that's a more helpful word, or is it more helpful or less? Emulate
sure.
Help?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Emulate means sort of like be an imposter, pretend that you are that person, mm-hmm. appear to be that person, you know. Do everything that person would do and nothing they wouldn't do.
Simulate.
And of course, that's where simulate. But emulate is the word we use in mm-hmm. technology.
Okay.
And that's where it gets kind of dicey, because then the next question is, well, all right, so let's say that WordPress actually does fully implement the Twitter API. What about features that WordPress has that Twitter doesn't have? Mm-hmm. Like, for example, you know, Twitter has a 140-character limit. WordPress doesn't have that limit.
Right.
So what do they do if you ask for a status message that has, or in this case, a blog post, which would be the equivalent, and it has more than 140 characters? What do they do? Again, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm going to have to look into that. And that's a very interesting question. Because if they answer that question by saying, well, you know, we got more than 140 characters, why don't we just return all the characters we have?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got, and it, now the Twitter guys might have a problem with it. Because, you know, well, then, you know, the question is, what would the clients do? You know, what would Tweety do at that point?
Mm-hmm.
Would Tweety say, oh, well, we got more than 140 characters, let's do something interesting with it? Or would Tweety say, we don't know what to do, and then take a gun out and blow its own brains out, which is, you know, sort of crash, right? Which is something, I mean, a colorful way of saying crash.
Now, you called this move deeply subversive. Was that the word you
used? I said insidious. I said deeply respectful and deeply insidious.
Could you explain that combination? Deeply respectful
Respectful meaning it's respectful because they didn't reinvent something. They said, well, this is good enough
right.
for us, and we'll just use it as it is.
Respect.
And that's respect in the true sense of the word. I listened to you, and I decided to accept your view of the world. I mean, it's more than respect. Respect means you listened. This is more than that.
Right.
Because they not only listened, they decided to get into agreement with you. The insidious part is because now you have all these questions. You know, I looked up insidious after using it. It was actually the perfect word. It's one of the, let me get the definition up here. Let me just read it to you. Define insidious. Okay. Beguiling but harmful. Intended to entrap, working or spreading in a hidden and unusually injurious way. It could be very bad for Twitter. For one thing, it freezes things. It means that they can no longer move the Twitter API without getting some agreement from WordPress. Or it may mean that. That's the question. You know, is now, because I also said, you know, does this mean that Twitter API is now an open standard? When you have two people implementing the same protocol, it's a good question as to whether or not it's now an open standard, and it largely depends on what Twitter, the company, does. And then if there is some, if they ignore the presence of WordPress, if Twitter ignores that fact that there's compatibility there and then breaks it, you know, breaks WordPress, well, we don't know what happens then. But it's, it all gets more complicated and more interesting from this point out, I think.
All right. I think I understand that. It is very interesting.
Yeah.
And it's
maybe
an aspect of the difference between Twitter, the company, and Twitter, the system that activates the idea of the live web.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is this conflict. It's I don't know if these things were really meant to be companies, Jay. Because and they are a lot of different things that are not companies, you know. And in this case, Twitter is something that, that may not even someday even involve Twitter, the company.
Let me ask you something else. You in recent weeks have started a Tumblr blog, a Pastor's blog, a WordPress blog, and you still have scripting.com on your old platform. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing this?
Because it's the reality of the times we live in, and I'm making software idea, you know, that there might, you might write for 15 different places. Mm-hmm. And, well, it's not might. You do. I mean, you do, Jay, right? You write for many of those places. You have a Tumblr blog. You have a Posterous, I think, now. And you certainly write for WordPress. And don't forget, Twitter is also part of this mix that I have, too.
Right.
And you write for all those places. So that's the reality. You know, this all sort of came to a head, I think, 2 years ago. It's just, it all of a sudden, what was a simple world was no longer very simple anymore. And then you were starting to, I was starting to worry about, okay, what would happen? You know, how do I find all my writing? Because I'm writing in all these millions of different places, you know. And so I'm trying to make it all, I'm trying to have it both ways. I'm trying to have it so that that my writing can be sprayed all over creation at the same time, all exist in one place where it can be searched and, you know, and archived and, you know, and maybe in some way coherent that it wouldn't be as when it's scattered all over the place. So yeah, I'm trying to have better editorial tools. Yeah.
Moving on.
I think we've talked about this, though.
Yeah, I understand it now. Moving on, there was some news in the strange world, but intensely interesting world of URL shorteners this week with BitLY. What happened?
Wow. Well, yeah, this was really, I think it all just happened yesterday, basically. First, there was a rumor that Facebook had come out with its own URL shortener. And it had been, their shortened URLs had been seen somewhere. And so it was more than a rumor. And then Google actually announced that they had now, that they now had a URL shortener. And they were using it in two contexts, in the context of Google Toolbar and in the context of FeedBurner. And what that means is, say you're a Google Toolbar user and you're on a web page and you want to tweet it. In other words, I want to say, okay, this is an article everybody who follows me should see. And so you're on, you got the toolbar there and you click a button that says retweet or tweet or whatever. And it pops up a dialog and says, what do you want to say about this? And when you click submit, it sends that text plus a shortened URL to Twitter. It also has the ability to send it to about a half a dozen other places as well, which makes it an embrace and extend move. It's totally expected. You know, Google and Microsoft both bought a license to Twitter's Firehose. And one of the things you're sure to see here, and we've now seen it from Google, is that Twitter would be seen as one of many places that you could shoot stuff at. And you can almost feel the presence of Google's Twitter now. You know, it'll be in that list. It'll probably be the default. And if they were to buy Twitter, which is something else, which has been rumored again that there's a deal in the works for them to buy Twitter, then of course Twitter would be the first item in that list. Google clearly needs to control this whole thing. And you know, and then there's also, so you can kind of infer from this, and I've also heard some rumors to this effect as well, that Bitly was trying to sell to Google. They asked for too much. This is all hypothetical, Jay. I just want to be clear. I don't know any of this for fact, okay? It's all hypothetical. It's just tea leaf reading. That they asked for too much. Google said, well, fine, we have a make versus buy decision, which is very classic in the tech industry. And they decided to make instead of buy. And that leaves poor Bitly, who I actually, to disclaim, played a role in founding. That leaves Bitly in sort of this horrible position of, well, they're a little startup with a huge product, and they're now facing competition from the very largest of tech companies, Google, and doesn't look so good for old Bitly at this point. So then they came out with, within hours of this, something called Bitly Pro, which is kind of a half measure. Not all the way. They should be a lot further along in this than they are. I mean, they've been out for a year and a half now, and they should really be much more deeply entrenched with developers than they are now. My guess is the reason why is they never expected to be independent at this point. They expected to be owned. Mm-hmm. So a lot of drama there, and you know, I would definitely not in any way count out Bitly. Somebody I read somewhere that they're shortening a billion URLs every month or something. You know, it's a lot of traffic flowing through that little company. So somebody's going to want to own that. You know, so.
Huh. Wow. All right. Anything else in your tech world you want to round up for listeners?
Yes. As a matter of fact, in New York, when I visited New York, I stopped by NYU, and I saw their new facility. I had no idea this existed.
NYU Journalism.
Talk a little bit more about this. That's correct. Do you mind if I give you the address?
No.
20, no?
20 Cooper Square.
20 Cooper Square. And it's brand new. It's beautiful. It's a little – there's a little auditorium, which I think was also like a TV studio. Can you webcast out of there?
Definitely. TV studio. It's a fully equipped TV studio.
Well, yeah. I meant that would be off on the side, the TV studio. But there's there's kind of like an auditorium, a small auditorium. It's also like a student lounge too.
Right.
So this is like your lab, right?
Yeah, this is our headquarters, and it has public space, it has studio space, it has classroom space, and it's in a pretty cool location, and it's done by world-class architects, Polshak Company, which does a lot of institutional work, but they're very good, and it's in the heart of the East Village.
Yeah, there's the new Cooper Union building. It's like right across the street from there.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
It's a very good location, incredible location, actually.
It is, and we hope to turn the public space into a real meeting ground for the people who are going to invent the next new system. So we're optimistic at NYU, even though the news business is in terrible shape. We still think there's a lot of life left in journalism. And
sure.
I'm recruiting students intensely now for the next class of Studio 20. I've been meeting with quite a few of them, and January 4th is our initial deadline, so those who are thinking of applying should definitely try and get their applications in, and I'm confident we're going to have a pretty good class in 2010.
Mm-hmm. So.
So, moving on.
What's next?
I launched a mock-up of a site that I've been talking about on this program, and I wanted to explain a little bit about it. It's called explainthis.org, and it's not really a site so much as a mock-up of an idea. And I published at my Tumblr this week and just forwarded the domain name explainthis.org to this Tumblr post. And all it shows when you go there, if you go to explainthis.org, is a box like Twitter's that you would see at this hypothetical site. And it says at the top, what's your question? Journalists are standing by. And I explain that unlike when you come to Facebook, which asks what's on your mind, or Twitter, which says what's happening, instead of updating your status, users would ask a question that they can't easily get the answer to themselves, that actually requires investigation by journalists. And I said that the kind of question that this site is really made for is one that lots of people have, so we know there's interest in the question, that can't be easily answered through a search or just by looking up the answer, and that requires journalistic investigation, digging, explanation, and resourcefulness. And it seems to me that if more of the professional and pro-am journalism that was done in answer to questions that lots of people had, we would have a more responsive news system. And so I see this just as one element, only one, of the rebooted system of news. And by launching it as a kind of a mock-up, which I did this week, I was able to get reactions from people who came by. So one of the first reactions lots of people had was, this is what librarians do, which kind of puzzled me a little bit, because I tried to say very clearly in my post that, well, this is really for questions that you can't easily answer with a good librarian. And I think there are plenty like that. But nonetheless, that's what a lot of people said. Librarians do this now. Then other people pointed me to other successful question and answer sites, which, of course, there are many. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good. Yahoo Answers isn't really very successful, but people talked about that. Mahalo is another one. One that a lot of people pointed me to was Stack Overflow in the programming world,
yeah,
where people ask questions.
That's Joel Spolsky, right?
Right. But as I understand it, I don't use Stack Overflow, but as I understand it, the answers come from the users as well.
Right.
So that's a little bit different than what I had in mind, but nonetheless relevant to what I had in mind. So
why couldn't these answers come from users?
I don't know.
Is there a prohibition against that? Or
no.
It could.
I think in practice what would happen is people would ask questions. Some of them could be answered by users, and that would be enough. Some of them probably could be answered by librarians who have access to more information than your average user, and maybe that would be enough.
Why bother making a distinction between journalists and librarians anyway? I mean, isn't the issue like you have a question and you need the answer to it? I mean,
yeah.
And aside from that, your question, why is corn still subsidized, probably isn't the kind of question a librarian would attempt to.
They
wouldn't reject it. What they would say is, well, let's try to break that down into its components, into things that I can help you with.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you're quite right that a journalist would definitely tackle a question like that.
Yeah.
Not necessarily ever expecting to get the answer either, right? I mean, as journalists don't always get you the answer, but they do sort of explore all the sides to it, right?
Yeah, but I think they should put a little bit more energy into trying to answer questions like that. Another one would be, why do we have no memorial at Ground Zero 8 years after the September 11th attacks, even though the nation has said that it wants a memorial? Why is there nothing there? A librarian can't really look that up. And while users might have theories about it and people can give their answers, I think it does take some investigation and some digging. I see that as the kind of question that journalists really should be able to answer. And so it's not that users couldn't answer them. It's not that librarians couldn't. It's that there are some questions that we need journalism for. That's the premise of my saying. And so the idea is that explainthis.org is really a method for surfacing those questions and also for registering interest in the answers and therefore motivating journalists to go out and find the answers and bring them back to people who we know want to know. So anyway, that's the idea. And I floated it not because I have venture capital to build this site or, you know, a team of 100 people who are waiting to spring into action. I don't. I don't just really just have the idea. But I figure by talking about it and visualizing it, even in this very crude fashion, that I would just trigger action toward it. And that's what's happening since I floated it. So it's gratifying. There's one guy in particular who came to my Tumblr post and said, you know what, I'm a developer, I work for Yahoo, and I like to have some projects of my own, and I'd certainly work on a mock-up of this, and he's working with me right now in it. So I'm optimistic that just by generating interest and discussion and examination and getting people to ask questions and answering their questions, which I've been doing in the comment thread, there's like 75 comments there now, I'm just moving the ball along on this concept.
So for your purpose, it's good enough to just address the question of what's the difference between a librarian and a journalist is certainly one that gets surfaced by this.
Yep.
Another one is technical people to you, which is also something that you like, right?
Yes.
You want that involvement. You want more developers to get involved in journalism.
Yes.
Right?
Uh-huh. Right.
Yeah.
And I want to form a tighter connection between demand and supply, which relates to something else I wanted to talk about. Remember I explained this company, which I call a demonic company, Demand Media, in a previous Rebooting the News?
Yes.
Well, yeah. I actually heard from the CEO of that company, Richard Rosenblatt, who's the founder and CEO of Demand Media. He emailed me and said, Jay, it's the demonic Richard Rosenblatt of Demand Media, you know, contacting you. And I don't think you get our mission. And, you know, can we talk? And I said, well, sure. Why don't we do an interview? Because then you can explain your mission not just to me, but to the people who follow me and to the web. So I have an interview with him scheduled for tomorrow. I hope it happens. I hope there isn't a problem or... I hope nobody backs out of it because I think it'd be quite.
How are you doing the interview? Or is it going to be? Are you going to have like audio for it?
I'm doing it by IM, and I'm going to run it as a transcript at my blog. That's what I told them. So we're going to do it on Yahoo IM and turn it into a Q&A, which I'll publish as soon as I edit it. And I just want to ask him about the mission of Demand Media, about some of the criticisms and alarms that have been raised about what are called by some people content farms or content mills. And he obviously feels misunderstood by some of what I've said, so I want to figure what that's all about.
Well, I can't wait to see this. This is
Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, this has been much discussed. In Arrington wrote a piece about
this
a few days ago.
Suddenly, it's everywhere.
Searles wrote a response to it, which I thought was fine. I think there's something that everybody has missed here, though, which is they think that that if this persists, that it's going to hurt people who are real, not fake people. You know, not people who are invented by demand, but rather like people who just existed without any demand, you know, which I think is very naive to think that that's the way it's going to go. I think it's the death of Google. If they can't find a way to factor this stuff out, that's it. No more Google. Google's broken. You know, it's not going to come at the expense. It's not going to come at the expense of the truth, because people are still going to want that, and they're not going to be fooled by fake news or fake information. They're not. You can tell when this stuff is junk, right? I don't know.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because with all the buzz around demand media, AOL going in a similar direction, these content farms and content mills, as they're called, also digital sweatshops is another name used for them. They all revolve, of course, around SEO games of one kind or another. And it did really bring home to me that Google is really faltering now. It's becoming almost a drag on the web in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I really think that they have a challenge in front of them. They have to figure this out, and they have to start acting in some way or another. It's not going to be easy, because demand media in particular is a major force on YouTube in creating videos on YouTube that actually do draw advertising and therefore begin to generate some revenue for YouTube, which is, of course, a Google property. So I think it's a big challenge to them. But to go back to my project, explainthis.org, I think there are fruitful ways of aligning supply and demand. And it's important to know what people want to know. And if quality producers, people who care about truth, who care about beauty, who care about doing a good job, and
how about care about survival of our species, Jay? Let's throw
that
one
too,
in there. How about people who care about whether or not their family members get health insurance or not?
Care about problems, care about solving problems.
I just wonder when the hell people are going to... Yeah, I mean, we have gotten into so much trouble in not just in our country, in the whole world, with this whole idea of, you know, creating quote-unquote value, and with the emphasis on the quotes, you know, as opposed to creating real value. I mean, look at the bubbles we've had to endure, you know. Well, this is the height of bubbling, you know. I mean, where is the value? I mean, you know, you have to, if you want to have an economy, right, somebody's actually got to create something that somebody wants, as opposed to just moving around decimal points on spreadsheets and somehow making it all come out so that they end up with some money and everybody else ends up the same, you know. There's so much scamming in all this stuff, but the scamming isn't a basis for life.
Right.
You know? So great, they've got a scam. You know, in a way, so does Google, because how many products do people actually buy from those ads? I mean, when is that question ever going to get asked? You know, let's put that.
It is being asked. That's part of the reason.
Explain this to me, Jay. How does this Google ad stuff? How does that actually work? I don't get it.
Well,
I see these ads all the time, and I never click on one. Do you? I never met this.
Very rarely, but the only way you can understand it working is by reference to an older system that worked even worse.
Yes, yeah.
So when we broadcast an ad out for Chevy or Coke or Zenith televisions over the radio or over, you know, Channel 11, it reaches even fewer people that are actually going to
buy.
But
that's different. That's different. That's positioning. I understand positioning, right? It's like, in other words, you're selling an image. I mean, the Droid is a great example. What's the difference between the Droid, which is a kind of cell phone, and the 80,000 other brands of cell phone that have not managed to break into the iPhone franchise? Well, the difference is they ran some really great ads. You know, that really is the difference, Jay. I mean, their ads were irreverent. They carved out a unique position. You know, the iPhone, they positioned the iPhone as being somewhat effeminate. and this was the macho, you know, super powerful, fast, you know, version of a cell phone. It all that I get. I understand positioning, but Google Ads can't be used for positioning because they have no imagery, because they're just little bits of text that exist on a screen. So they really can only be used for merchandising. I mean, maybe they'll change that at some point, and maybe I'm wrong. I mean, maybe somehow you can do that kind of advertising with it, but I don't see it.
Well, the advantage they have is targeting more narrowly.
Correct. Right. So maybe they do kind of work, but now here's the end of it. This is the end of the road right now. The road's going to end eventually anyway, because searching is so much better at finding you the information you want than the sort of hitchhike like message that's, you know, interrupts you in the middle of whatever it is you're doing. That isn't what you're looking for, you know.
But these content mills may frustrate search. They are about interrupting search.
Right.
They're about polluting search, you know. And
yeah,
that's
totally
the problem.
Google will figure that one out. They will. I'm convinced. They'll find a way to fix it.
I think
if you have an algorithm, it's kind of like, you know, you invent an algorithm that can work around my algorithm. Okay, great. Now I'm going to have to come up with an algorithm that figures out that you're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they will. I don't know. Whatever.
Reminds me of something Norman Mailer once said, the only mind a novelist cannot enter is the mind of a novelist greater than himself.
I see. So you put a character in your book who's a novelist who happens to be better than you, and it ain't going to work, right?
Kind of
funny.
A demonic thought to go with the demonic demand medium. Anyway, I hope that this interview comes off because I want to hear what the man has to say. I want to hear him explain his company and what it's up to. And I do think that journalists need to listen to the man without obeying it too much, and they also need to sometimes speak right into the man without knowing whether there's any market for their work at all, you know? And that's as important as being responsive, but it isn't one or the other. It's a creative blend of both. I also think that there are certain questions that remain about news events that have been endlessly reported and endlessly discussed, and yet we still don't have answers to the most basic questions. And when those kinds of questions remain and nobody does try to answer them, it creates cynicism about the news, and it actually depresses demand and interest in the news. And that's another agenda item of mine in creating explainthis.org.
So if you let industry control what, and in a sense that's what demand media is doing, if you let industry control what we hear in news, I mean, yeah, that builds cynicism. And you end up with a situation where you can have healthcare reform that actually doesn't get anybody any more healthcare than was before, you know? They just laugh at us. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Thought that, you know, eventually the internet is so disruptive that this demand media stuff is like anti-disruptive. It's like homogenized people. It's, you know, well, I don't believe in it. I just don't.
Yeah, it's an attempt to control a disruptive force and make it obey more laws. Sort of like taking a wild river and making it run through, you know, specified channels.
We have to come up with a whole theory for this because it's a Tim O'Reilly. Tim O'Reilly has this really interesting a law or something. I forget how he characterizes it. He says you should be producing more value than you capture. That's
right.
The measure of a good business, right? And
right.
You know, you can look at a lot of the businesses that have made people very rich in the last few years, and for the most part, they're just capturing value that was sitting out there. And
right.
Those are the bad businesses because we need more businesses or we need more value, period. Never mind whether it was created by a business or by somebody with a good idea who didn't care about business, you know.
Create more value than you capture, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of the businesses that Tim promotes and helps actually don't follow that rule. So it's an interesting discussion, which we should continue in future Rebooting the News, because we're now out of time.
Dave, so, it's been a pleasure as always.
As always, Jay. See you next week.
Bye.